from Social Service Dashi. I'm Jing Yao, co-hosting this episode with Isaac, who will introduce our guest.
Thanks, Jing Yao, for having me back. So for today, inspired by the short story Sin in Singaporean writer Ng Yi Sheng's collection Lion City, What's the Matter, Mr. Monster? Is a dialogue-driven game where one role plays as a civil servant, settling complaints of otherworldly creatures settling into Singapore. Today, with director Roshan Singh, we dive into its genesis at Singlet Station Singlet Block Party, features of the game, and its potential for community and civic engagement.
Welcome to the podcast, Roshan. To start, maybe tell us a little bit more about the game and how your team got started on the game and producing the game.
Sure. So thanks for having me. So to say a little bit about the game, my name is Roshan. I'm from Andas Productions. We're a Singapore-based digital storytelling team. And earlier this year, we released a game called What's the Matter, Mr. Monster? And this was a piece of, I guess, interactive fiction is what we like to call it. Very dialogue heavy. You click through, you talk to, well, Mr. Monsters. So I think in the game, they're actually ungendered. So that's a fun bit of, now that I think about it. But yeah, no, we released it in collaboration with Singlet as part of the blog party that they hosted. And yeah, we spent about 2 to 3 months on conceptualizing it, programming it, getting the art and the sound of the music done. And it was developed in kind of like a game jam environment, where I think a lot of it was ideas flowing quick, implementing quick, and it also being the first time we made a dialogue-driven game. It was also sort of like an experiment in building the ship as we were sailing it. Happy to talk about any of that.
Yeah. I know, because I'm not very well versed. What's game jamming? Explain what game jamming means. Yeah,
gladly. So a game jam is sort of like a hackathon for people in that crowd, or a 24-hour play for people in that crowd. And for people in neither crowd, I'll go into more detail. It's essentially an environment where you have a certain stretch of time, a quick amount of time. You're given sort of like a prompt. Design a game about, let's say, sometimes it's hope. Design hope. And then what you do in that environment is that you assemble a team of like your musicians, your artists, however many people you can find, and you just implement. You just code. You just start coding, and you sort of see what comes out at the end of it. And it's a wonderful environment. Anyone who's done a hackathon and anyone who's done a 24-hour play can tell you that you often surprise yourself with the result of it. It's a wonderful like little redemptive exercise. And if you're really struggling, feeling like you have no good ideas, you do a game jam and you realize, oh yeah, it's not just about having a good idea. It's about having a good team, because all of you just surprise yourselves with what you're capable of when you just start working.
So this game jam was specially for doing this Singlet block party? Like it was held specially for that?
So I should clarify, I mentioned that it's a game jam-like environment, which may have been a little confusing. All I meant by that is that we had a certain quick amount of time, we had the team, and we had the prompt, which was, I think, if I recall right, yeah, the prompt was to develop a game that showcases Singapore literature. And the people at Singlet, I cannot say enough good things about them. They were really, really open-ended, very generous, and they said, let's just talk about what a game that celebrates Singapore literature could be, and go from there.
Okay. Now, that's quite fascinating because like it's like two different environments, you know, programming and literature, which don't often go together. They don't interact often. So yeah, that's really interesting. How was the process of working with the team like? I think you definitely work with Yi Sheng and the others. And so we should mention to listeners on the podcast that Yi Sheng is a Singaporean writer who has won the Singapore Literature Prize. Yeah, so Roshan, how was the process of working with him and the rest?
So I'll say this, and this might be surprising, but I've actually still never spoken to Yi Sheng. And the reason his work was chosen, and this is an important thing, is because I was a fan of it. And I think a lot of this came from an appreciation of Yi Sheng's work. I think just wanting to do like a love letter to Singapore literature is where the initial sort of idea of it was. And for me, I think the short story Sin was one of my favorite stories in one of my favorite anthologies of local work, Lion City. And so then let me take you 3 steps back. So the people we did talk to a lot were the Singlet team. And that was Charlene, Olivia. And yeah, no, so the way that process worked was they reached out to me as somebody who has done theater, who has done, at that point, I'd released one browser game with Andas Productions. And I think what they did was they said that you seem like somebody who has a lot of cross sections between literature and programming and all this stuff. And where you're the person we want to talk to about developing a game that is also something which celebrates literature. And it's right. It's what you were saying earlier is absolutely spot on, which is that programming and literature, you do think of them as fairly separate. But I'm really lucky to be sort of working with a team of, you know, a lot of them are liberal arts graduates like myself. And I think it is an environment, certainly internally in the team, where I think we just don't really care about those distinctions. The leading thing is like, what do you love? And for me, I love games. I love this literature. And I think when you know that you love reading this stuff, you love playing this stuff. And I think just as important, you love making it. I think that's kind of what led us to say yes to Singlet and to investigate it. And one interesting thing with Mr. Monster was that I'm actually, in addition to being the Undust founder and sort of creative director, I'm also the programmer. So I think that helps give the sense of like, I'm very new to programming as well. This is the second game I've released and made. There's this sense of kind of like, well, we know at the end of the day, the person who will really suffer if the scope is too huge is me. So like, there's this sense of kind of like, of almost humility to it, where we're kind of like, when we're talking to Singlet and we're sort of thinking, what ideas are possible? It really helped guide the early phase because we were very intentionally from this perspective of let's really set a narrow scope of something that we would really love to do, but we also know that we can do. And yeah, I think without the love of, or at least without the love of literature combined with a willingness to program, I imagine that especially for a young team, it's very common and very easy for projects like this to sort of spiral into wanting it to be a combination of, let's say, as a celebration of Singapore literature being the goal, right? Let's say a four-genre mashup, sort of WarioWare style or Mario Party style, where every time you click on a different book, you're doing something different. The game was almost that. In early discussions of Singlet, we're like, yeah, it should be like a broad sampling of all this different stuff. And we thought about it. We're like, actually, we should probably don't want to end all of our lives like that so quickly. Probably best to scale. So to answer your question one more time, I think in terms of what the process was like, especially at the early stages, I would say it was about streamlining our focus and really pinpointing it to like, if the guiding principle is what we love, let's find one thing that we love first. Just one thing we love and just go from there. And that led us to Lion City and Sin.
Yeah. And you touched on a number of points that are of curiosity to me and Isaac. And so I imagine we'll touch on them in the rest of the interview as well. We've been talking so much about the game itself. I thought that would be a nice kind of follow-up from your last response, right? Because the audio platform of the podcast means it's not necessarily the best place to talk about a visual game. But for folks who are thinking of going into it and playing with it, help us walk through what's the meta, Mr. Monster, right? So what will a player first see? What's the experience like? How will he or she or they proceed with the game? And, you know, what's at the end of the game in that sense? Just give us a rough sense of how it's going to look like.
That's such a wonderful exercise. I'll say this. Andas does two things. We do video games and audio fiction, which are kind of like podcast TV shows. So I think the idea now of taking our video game and giving it an improvised audio fiction spin-off is hilarious to me. But again, I'll try. So I think the idea is when you start up What's the Matter, Mr. Monster? It's playable on any browser, on any computer. Unfortunately, no mobile phone version yet. We had so many discussions about that. But for now, desktop browser. You type in, I think it's ministryofmonsters.sg.
That's correct.
I can double check that.
That's correct.
Yeah, I should really know that. What happens is the game just boots up by itself. It's free to play, sort of like old Flash games is kind of the model. You click to start, and what happens is you're immediately facing a desk, which has a notebook full of information on it. You have a little board full of questions that you have to ask for the ministry on your left, and a phone to your right, where you end up calling and sort of making official decisions. So the idea there is that, well, let me get to that later. The first thing that happens is you have to pick up the phone because someone's calling you. Mm-hmm. And it's your very stern boss. And your boss is basically telling you, hey, please, you need to hurry up. You need to just, these cases are coming in. Just handle them. I don't care how you do it. Can you just get it over with? And immediately a monster comes in and it's the most friendly, delightful little thing you've ever seen in your life. And it's adorable. But it's got a real issue, which is it's got like an accidental theme that emerged across the development of this game was this sort of sense of place being a huge thing, displacement, or, you know, and that took the form of a lot of like housing issues. Like the idea in the game being that when these monsters arrived in Singapore, these delightful, generally pleasant monsters just all over the place, the issue wasn't that monsters were existing or attacking people. It's that people had no idea what to do with them or where to put them. Or, you know, and even though they're these lovely, lovely things and they have all kinds of shapes and sizes, I think what we really enjoyed about Yixing's work with Sin, and I think this sort of, it's this interesting thing where it's neither a sequel nor a prequel. We wanted this game to be set right in the middle of that story where monsters have emerged. They're very pleasant, but Singapore has no idea what to do with them, where to put them, how to integrate them with society. And the thought experiment following that story was, well, what would that look like? What would a Singaporean bureaucrat, and we've all either met or been at some point in our lives, a Singaporean bureaucrat. And there's this very odd dance, right? Where it's like, if there's any statement we're making about Singaporean bureaucracy in the game, it's this. It's that you don't demonize the bureaucrat. You don't demonize the bureaucrat. Because in this game, you are the bureaucrat. You are the one being told, no, go on. You have all the tools to be the helpful, compassionate, kind person that we all aspire to be, and see for a moment how tedious that can be, how difficult that can be, how sort of the hoops you jump through when you are given a form, and the form says, you know, you have to just do something with this case, not a person, not even in this case a entity, but a case in front of you. And the easiest thing to do in all of these cases, in which you learn by interacting with the first monster, is to take the barest minimum information, and then you're ready to dismiss it. And sort of, it can be a pain because sometimes they don't always give you the information that would help you help them. Sometimes they go on these long tangents, and you kind of click through going, ah, oh, you know, now you're telling me about, you know, about your, there's this granddaughter, and she's like making bears for you, and, you know, and you're just trying to get to the point. And I think that's the thing. In the original conception of the game, there was actually a timer that would tick down and really make it even harder for the player, because what we wanted to stress was the idea of you role-playing a civil servant being someone who, like, and the UI kind of reflects this. On the left of the screen, you have these questions you have to ask, right? On the right hand of it, you just make the call. Very little about that setup reflects compassion or kindness. Like, the whole thing is geared towards, here are your parameters, execute them. And the timer is actually interesting because we realize that there's a tension between game design and sort of like, I think the conceptual element of it, where, let me put it this way, it wasn't fun. I think, in fact, if anything, it was unpleasant. It created this feeling of playing the game and being like, I'm just being punished at every level. And sort of like, and I think what we realized is that we wanted to immerse people in feeling or getting a sense of what these pressures are. But if you recreate the pressures too accurately, people will feel like they are doing a 9-to-5 desk job in what is probably like their 8 p.m., 9 p.m. after work, actual hours. Nobody wants to work after work, much less while playing a free browser game, right? So I think it was that thing of giving people a taste of the experience became our kind of guiding principle. So I've talked enough about the game. Let me go back to sort of taking you through it. The point is, you have this dinky little slime thing in front of you, and little conversational bubbles sort of pop up around it. And it's your job to sort of get all the facts, as many facts as you can, so that when you click on that phone and you click on which ministry you're going to call to settle the monster's case, that you can tell that ministry one of the few clues you've collected. Like, let's say that in this case, you've learned that, okay, there's this creature and the creature is hanging outside this building. You can immediately call people to go to that building and to swoop it up and lock it away. Or you could stick with it long enough, have the conversations, unlock the clues that tell you that this creature is always hungry, but it's hungry for trash. And you can call up the ministry that sends it to Pulau Semakau and just like have it eat endless mountains of garbage. And that way it's happy, you're happy. But that took you like probably a couple of minutes longer than it would have if you had just done the easier thing. And that's sort of the tension that survives the rest of the game. Is the joy of it, in terms of the game design perspective, is let's come up with as many interesting situations as possible. Make it wackier and wackier. Really push it in terms of like what you can do with the monster, diversifying what kind of information you're getting, their personalities. The visuals are a huge part of it as well. The delight of sort of each of the monsters kind of has this, leaning into our audio fiction roots a bit, like a little foley of like, what will it sound like when they enter? What will it sound like when they leave? And I think, yeah, that sort of became the joy of the game, was sort of not what we thought. What we thought it would be is kind of like this time crunch thing of making the right calls, making the right decisions. And what we turned into was, yeah, this more almost visual novel-esque kind of experience. Yeah.
Yeah. And I know Isaac's going to jump in because when you were sharing, two kind of thoughts came to my mind when you were sharing there. And number one, when I texted you about doing a podcast interview, I said, I'm not a huge gamer, but I know the game reminds me of another video game called Papers, Please, right? Which I happened to play some time ago. And that is interesting also because you are essentially role-playing as a checkpoint inspector of a war-torn country, a very new country, and you're making decisions based on immigration documents, how they look, and all these things. So that reminded me very visually of that. I think the second thing would be, which would be interesting and a comment, more of a comment than a question. I'm actually interested to hear from folks who listen to this podcast, especially the social workers and civil servants who listen to the podcast, because to do it as a citizen who has had no experience is a bit different. But if this was a almost recreation of a day-to-day lived experience, then that's something that I think will be fascinating to kind of dive into in terms of how, I don't think it's a matter of accuracy. It's more of to what extent does it actually represent the experiences that they go through on a day-to-day basis, right? Because, you know, one might say for social workers, which with whom I'm more familiar, they deal with cases on a day-to-day basis. And so dealing with that complexity might not be something that's new. And I'm interested, you know, it's not for you, but for listeners to kind of think about and then see what their thoughts might be. Yeah.
I would love to see the responses to that question.
You know, if we have, yeah. Sorry, Isaac, I almost cut you off. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say whatever you just said, Roshan, about experiences playing the game. Yeah, I witnessed that because when I went through the game, things like you mentioned, like how the monsters started rambling and so on. And I had to click through when I had to assign them to the so-called correct ministries and so on. Then I didn't always get it right. Yeah. So I was just like thinking did I miss something? Did I click through too fast? Can I go back? sort of things.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. I'm so glad to hear that.
Yeah, so I've also read Yi Sheng's short story, Sin. So it's quite interesting to hear about the decision you took to focus more on that middle section, because the overall story, I think, is more of allegory on Singapore's treatment of refugees, migrant workers, so on. So yeah, I guess what kind of, I guess, direction or sort of experience you wanted people to get out of this game, you know, by throwing them into this sort of perspective of a civil servant?
So one thing that we've learned through game design is that the number one thing to talk about is always, always, always player experience. Like, I think we tend to think about it in terms of or I tend to think about it coming from a theater background or TV background is what's the story, right? And the weird thing with games is that it's not so much about the story you're telling the player so much as the story they sort of craft for themselves or the experience they had. That's the thing that they remember. And I think with this game, we wanted the player, I kind of touched on this a little bit just now, but the idea of getting a sense of what sort of decisions a bureaucrat might have to make, a civil servant might have to make operating in that system, how that person can try to find sort of the best possible solution, ways that kind of I think there's a line from the boss in the game, something like serve the country, solve the issue, something. But there's this sort of juggling act that you have to do. And I think this game was supposed to be about giving you a taste of the juggling act without making you sort of so unduly stressed by sort of the recreation of it that you... I'll also say this, that I think your comment just now about feeling like you got some stuff wrong is really what I want to hear. I think as a game designer, and this is one of the first times I'm talking to people in a setting like this who've played the game, is what my intention was to make a game that most people would play once, that some very dedicated people might play twice to mop up, and then are likely to never play again. I don't think most or anyone would have a third playthrough, but we definitely wrote the game with two playthroughs in mind, with it being totally fine if somebody missed one. And I think exactly that feeling is what we were hoping for with the first playthrough, that curiosity. And part of that is reflected in a comment made, really impromptu, I think almost a couple of hours before we release the game, we included one feature that before then didn't exist, which was the creature that you deal with first pops up right at the end to make a comment about what your first choice was. And that creature alludes to you either having helped it out a lot, or maybe there's a different way you could have done it the first time. And I think what I really liked about that moment was I am a massive sort of video game player. And I think the moment that changed the indie game scene, I think forever, was when Undertale, which is an indie game that was released in the past few years, there's a moment right at the beginning of that where you kill the first boss, you move into the next room, and the antagonist of the game comes out and goes, hey, you know, you really didn't have to kill that person. And what the average player would do is they would then reset their game file, and go back, redo the boss, realize you don't have to kill them, and then feeling very proud of yourself, you walk through. And then the antagonist finds you again and went, wow, so you really reloaded your save to do that, huh? Well, you still kill them the first time, and that'll haunt you forever. And then it laughs at you and disappears, and you're like, oh no! You know, and I think that feeling of shock, that feeling of being seen by a game, is something that I think so many games since then have tried to recreate. And even though it's just a tiny thing, and I think it's that awareness that we use the same game studio, we use the same game engine to make this game as was used to make Undertale, which is something that we thought about a lot. We're like, if this engine can do that, then certainly we can use it for... Yeah, you know, it's just the kind of thing where we knew that we could probably find some way to read player inputs and respond to them. We should do something to remind the player that, like, to create that feeling of, oh my God, what if I did something different? So all of this is to say, when you're talking about my intended player experience, I just have to say that what you described resonates very perfectly with what I hoped a player experience would look like. Sam, I'm very glad to hear that.
Okay. Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I just wanted to also just touch a bit on gaming communities, because your game is like a single player game. So like there's a message to get out of it from the developers to the gamers. But there are a lot of other games online. There are more multiplayer games. But unfortunately, it seems like, you know, in the press, in the media, there's a lot of coverage on how in a lot of these communities, like the interactions, the atmosphere is sometimes more toxic than pleasant, you know, especially between gamers in the community. Do you think like games like yours, or perhaps, I guess yours is a single player game, but, you know, multiplayer games can form, you know, communities, they can build more civic engagement, perhaps to sort of invoke reflections that you wanted, like your game wanted gamers to feel?
You know, I think the first thing that comes to mind is this. We made a game that I think, well, here's a bit of an odd example to pull from. In Man of Steel by Zack Snyder, right at the end of it, there was a, you know, what happens is that there's this impossible situation faced by Superman, and it really looks like there's no way that he can solve that situation apart from snapping the villain's neck. And that created this very interesting conversation in the film-going community where people said basically, you know, why did Superman kill that person? And the response was, well, you know, he had to. He didn't have a choice. And I think the response to that, the counter to that counter that I think has left a deep impression on me is, but, you know, Superman didn't have a choice, but the writers did. You know, if you come up with a scenario where the only winning move is murder, then you are at fault for the fact that Superman had to kill that guy. And I think about that a lot in terms of game design as a way of sort of asking what tools are we giving our players? You know, what sort of, how are we writing them into situations that... So here's another interesting anecdote. I believe this regards Fallout 3, which was developed by Bethesda. And what happened in that game was that you start off as a kid, and, you know, your father is sort of talking to you. And what happened that was really interesting was that the developers learned through playtests that the first thing that almost every single player did upon being let loose into the world was try to attack the father. Like, they would look for a weapon, go back to the father, and beat the father up. And if I recall right, it went something along the lines of they would try to, like, make the weapons further away, or they would, like, make it so you can't pick it. Like, but basically what happened was that the more they tried to sort of make it harder for players to do inconvenient acts like that, players would still find a way to do it. So I think that's a complementary sort of answer to my first thing, which is, on the one hand, game designers should try to minimize opportunities for abuse in our games. But the second thing is that if avenues exist to pursue certain outcomes, even though they're wild outcomes, they don't meet the story of your game, they don't meet the themes of your game, if there's opportunities for engagement in that game, players will use it. You know, like if you give them a way to draw something on the wall, they will definitely use it to draw things you don't want them drawing anywhere. You know, like, so it is this thing where the tools we give players end up reflecting, and A, players will find a way to do anything they want. if you give them the license to do that. But number two, they also reflect the chaos of sort of online communities in general, where you look at Reddit, right? Like, how often has Reddit come under fire for what subreddits are capable of, you know? And it does raise this question of, so all that said, I think what we did in creating What's the Matter, Mr. Monster, was we created a game with a very narrow set of verbs, where really all you can do really is engage, be kind, call up, make a decision, you know? Like it's, or I think it's like talk, call, and I think maybe study are really like the three big verbs for us. I was also raised on multiplayer games, you know? I was raised on MMOs. I was raised on, you know, how many of us have like RuneScape stories where you were hanging out in the RuneScape area you shouldn't have been, someone killed you and stole all your stuff? Or next level, how many people have been in the supposedly nice areas of RuneScape and had all of their belongings scammed from somebody who said they would trade you 1,000,000 gold? They suddenly change it to 1 gold at the last minute, take all your stuff, and then 12-year-old you is crying, right? If you give people avenues for abuse in multiplayer environments, it's very likely that they'll find it if you give them enough freedom to. So I guess that's the thing. It's like, I do like making single player games where we're able to curate an environment for a player, not just to do the right thing, but I think also to have that sweet spot of sort of engaging with the game in a really curated way where you know the experience they're going to get out of it. And they can have multiple avenues to sort of pursue that. So like the first thing we did before What's the Matter, Mr. Monster is an action game. We did an arcade action game, which is a brawler beat 'em up. Yeah, you know, I think it's the sort of thing where, and I guess this is where we sort of fall into that debate of like, do violent movies make violent people? Do violent games make you a more violent person? Do kind games that are life-affirming make you a kinder, more life-affirming person? To which I know that's a much, much bigger issue than the scope of the podcast. What I'll say is this. I do think that the opportunity to perform kindness in a game is something which, especially the ability to perform kind acts in a game does influence, it does change something in you. Ah, I have another anecdote. BioWare's Mass Effect 1. They were surprised, BioWare, when collating data from players and saves in Mass Effect 1, that a vast overwhelming majority of people were going the hero rather than the villain route. Like they were choosing to be a Paragon player, which means you treat people with dignity, rather than, and that was really surprising to them because they had built a game where you could choose to be good or choose to be evil. And they had, you know, from a game developer's perspective, that's a lot of time that you're basically spending 50-50% allocation of resources, but people are overwhelmingly choosing to be good. I do think there's this thing where people want to feel good. They don't want to feel bad playing the game. Most people are playing games, especially action games, late at night and after work, after school. So I think if you can make a game that makes doing good feel good, I can't help but feel like that does something to the player. Because we are desensitized to violence. We are desensitized to action. I am desensitized to violence and action. And I don't think that's a bad thing in itself. I'm not going to do it in real life. But I do think empathy is a muscle. And keeping it stretched is never a bad thing. And making a game that allows you to do that while enjoying yourself certainly couldn't hurt.
Wow. Okay. No, that's a great answer. Like, it's great to hear from like the game developer's perspective. I do game. So I played like a few of these games where, you know, you have these two separate paths, good and the bad. And yeah, actually, I think reflecting, like you said, a lot of people choose the good one. For me personally, I choose the good one because I feel like it's shaped in a way to make that the sort of canon ending. Like, no?
I agree. Yeah.
So I'd rather go that path because I'm like, okay, I want to see like the so-called canon ending first.
Yeah. And then you go back and do the bad playthrough, right?
Yeah. Because I want to see the alternatives.
Exactly. It's such an interesting problem. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. Well, I could go on and on about this, but yeah, I think that's not for this podcast. We can go through it a separate time. Okay, so yeah. So I guess I just wanted to ask a final question. So I noticed that quite a few members of your team, if not all of them, are from Yale and US. So I need to ask, did that community play a big role, you know, in helping to shape the way you think of the game designing process, the way you shape the narratives of the games, the overall development? And what does the impending loss of this community, or I guess not the I guess people will still be there, you know, your friends and all that, but the loss of that space, that environment mean to all of you guys?
Yeah, and I guess first off, RIP, but like, you know, it is a loss. It is such a tremendous loss. But to begin on a lighter note, yeah, no, it is true. It is true. A lot of people that... So I went to Yale NUS. I graduated in 2018. And I think when I was there, I met sort of... I came in as a neuroscience student, actually. I feel like that's worth saying. I didn't go to Yale NUS to study arts. In fact, many of my favorite creative collaborators I met at Yale NUS also did not go there to study art. But I think Yale NUS, quite crucially, was a place where, you know, it is a place of extreme privilege, just in terms of the opportunities the school afforded, not just in terms of resources, but also in terms of, I think, really stressing a balance of your academics and your extracurricular time. I think there was one distinguishing factor that really set it apart, more than sort of whatever facilities it had. Actually, I would say it's that spirit of it, which is that, like, treat your after-school academics very seriously. And giving us the time and respect to kind of manage that. And so how that manifested for me was that beginning as a neuroscience student and then realizing that I could dip my toe into like doing theater productions every semester. I'd never done a theater thing before that, but suddenly I think it just felt like, why not? Why not try it? I've always been interested. I've enjoyed seeing good plays. I have this sense of what that could look like. Let me just, okay, you know, you want to hold a script? You know, just book a room. Okay, done. We're making theater, you know, and then just kind of like scaling up from there. I think what I found in Yale and US were a lot of people who shared that specific disposition, which is like, I think that sense of like, hey, let's just do it. Let's just do it. You know, like, let's just go, let's figure out how to do it and then do it. So I think that was, you know, it's not that people who go to Yale and US are built different in any way. I don't think they are. A lot of them, like myself, like almost went to NUS, like almost went to any other number of places. And, you know, it raises this question of, I think, why I think I found these collaborators is because, frankly speaking, it's because every time in Yale and US, I said, does anybody want to do something? The people who form my creative collaborators now are very often the people who are just like, yeah, I want to do something. I want to try something. I'm willing to spend some time making stuff that we all think is cool. I think that if you took that attitude, or if you took that sort of like environment and you brought in any number of students from any number of our existing universities, you would find a very similar response. I don't know that a lot of us, like I came from an A-level background. I came from like an O-level background. And I never felt like that beforehand. I never felt like I could just mess around. You know, the sense I got from like a whole bunch of my friends who were doing similar courses in other universities, they never felt, or they reported never feeling like, it was a bit of a wild idea to them that your extracurriculars could be as important as your academics. And I get that because that's how it had always felt for me before Yale and US. But at the same time, I would say that like predominantly my life right now, everything that's good about it to me came from having that unlocked realization of you can, you know, if you dedicate yourself to like learning how to program. I learned how to program like last year. We now have 2 released games. You know, I learned how to do audio plays while we were making our first one, and it was like nominated for a Webby alongside like the HBO, Comedy Central. You know, I could go, and you know, like it's this kind of thing where like I think it's a dispositional thing that was not unique to Yale NUS, and that's why I think I don't feel like because Yale NUS no longer exists, therefore Singaporeans can't be as creative. No, I mean Singaporeans have always been creative. Singaporeans have always been sharp. They've always been highly skilled and highly talented. None of that is going away. I think the thing that is going away and which I grieve for future generations of students is being told explicitly by a respected institution that your free time is valuable and that you should pursue your passions is something that I don't know. For all I know, NUS College will do that and be that, you know, but and I'm not one to say it can't be that. All I can say is I will grieve the loss of an institution that very much was that. And I hope something else replaces it. We all win if NUS College is a success. We all win if any of these new educational institutions are a success. And yeah, I think that's where I am. And so I really, really hope that that spirit doesn't die. And you know, you look at all the people who graduated from Yale NUS, like And they're not one block, you know? Like, you have different Yale and US students who have different beliefs. Like, you will talk to Yale and US students who think that, like, academics are the most important thing in the world. And that's how they approach the school. You know, like, I'm telling you the school is a sandbox. So I expect that you will find people who will describe it very differently than I did. I think that's the joy. I think that's the beauty of it. But I think my hope is that, like, those people who graduated from Yale and US, like, good for them. They were privileged to have been able to go through that thing. Now our task as graduates of that school is to try to, like, I think to make sure that we are giving back and sort of like I'm an educator myself. I'm a teacher. I love teaching. And I will bring to every single classroom I teach for the rest of my life the best of what I got from Yale and US. You know? And I think a lot of us feel that way. Certainly a lot of the people on my team, I know that, like, to us, there's this thing now of, like, Yale and US is, like, in Asia for the world thing is dead. But, like, our company, that's us, right? We're trying to, like, take local creatives who aren't just from Yale and US. I want to stress that, actually, that, like, when it comes to my working experience, the people I'm working with, I've had the joy of working with before. But, you know, like, anytime we find someone who's passionate about what they do in Singapore, really from anywhere, because, like, we've worked with people from Indonesia, from, like, Philippines. In fact, some people from Philippines and Indonesia are a core part of our team right now. And so I think for me, it doesn't matter. Like, if you are a decent person, we want to give you a shot and we want to give you a chance. And we want to sort of, like, take this stuff and sort of, you know, we're lucky to have a platform that's international, right? We're lucky that, like, our projects have been received so well, like, in places like the States and London. So why not just take that bridge, take Singaporean talent that is not necessarily from Yale and US, but that, which I think, like, many Singaporeans who aren't, I mean, I think you get the point. I'm at risk of repeating myself.
I would say my commiserations for the lost. I resonate with it because I wasn't from UNUS, but I was from USP, which is part of the program that's being merged. And I don't have, most of my time was spent outside college. And obviously, I completely understand what you meant by, you know, having the opportunity to do different things and encountering and going through a program differently. There's no one way to go out doing so. And I think it's the first time I've distinctly heard from someone about a commitment to try to make the upcoming initiative as successful as possible. And I think we all hope the same way as well, you know. So to end on a more positive note in that sense, we would like to thank you for your time. I would just say that, you know, we are going to link to Yisheng's collection. Sin is in Lion City. It's going to be linked. We're going to link to the game as well. Thank you for taking time off the schedule to talk to us. We've been rescheduling a few times. I hope you're feeling better after your COVID bout. And yeah, we hope to see more games and audiobooks and productions from your team and organization down the road. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Roshan.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, it's a pleasure. I can't wait to listen to this and more of the episodes, honestly. It's such a pleasure.
Thank you.